from Relay. This is Downstream, a podcast about the present and future of television. This is episode number 96, recorded May the 29th, 2025. I am your master of ceremonies, Jason Snellen. With me is Joe Adalian, West Coast editor at Vulture. Welcome, Joe. Welcome back.
Thank you, sir. It's always good to be back. Thank you for having me.
Always. I always have a good time. We talked beforehand and you're like, I don't know about podcasting and all that. And I'm like, we have a great conversation every time. So it's great. I'm so glad
it's fun
that you could join me.
It's fun. It's fun for me. It just feels like, there's no alcohol or coffee involved, but it feels like just sitting down talking to a smart guy like you about television. And
it's great
Hollywood
to talk to somebody who knows so much about it. And of course, and people who follow you on social media, I always appreciate the archaeology that you do of old TV, and you find like the YouTube clips where it's literally somebody left a VCR running on a Tuesday night on CBS in 1984, and they find that tape and they just put it on YouTube, and you get all the commercials and the local news and it's so good. I mean, people should follow TV Mojo. Blue Sky is probably the right place to do it at this point.
Blue Sky is the only place these times. I don't post to the Nazi site. I don't post to that site, yes, anymore, except rarely, unless there's a big story, in which case I'm like, all right. But then even when I do, no one sees it because it's like there's no engagement.
Okay.
If you go there,
you will not see Joe's posts. Anyway.
it's sort of hidden by the
But
the
man,
obscuring machine.
The spelunking, the archaeology of that stuff. It's so great.
I forgot that's actually in my, I always forget that's in my little hand, my profile, like YouTube archaeologist.
I
coined that 15 years
it's
ago.
So
I remember
good.
When YouTube first came out, and spoiler, we may be talking about this later. I was still blown away by just seeing some of this stuff. It's like, this is the greatest invention in the history of mankind that I can literally just on my computer call up something from my childhood, you know.
I went through a period because I was a compulsive videotaper. And
I thought I was going someplace else.
Yes, no, compulsive
okay.
videotaper. I have so many VHS tapes. And I went through a period in the, I think, early 2000s, maybe mid 2000s, where I was like, okay, I am going to digitize these things that I saved that are so great, that are like classic memories of history and all of those things. And I realized one tape in that everything that I had saved was on YouTube already.
Oh, man.
So, which is great because I didn't have to digitize it. I'm sure there were some
local... But your copies were better.
I'm sure there were local ads and stuff that I could have done, but I had that moment where I just realized it's like, oh, yeah, all like Don Giller has posted all the David Letterman highlights because he literally, yeah. That was what he did before Letterman, I think, hired him to work on his YouTube channel.
he did, yes. So, it's still good, though, because sometimes channels go away or they get taken down for unrelated things.
Exactly.
It's like,
you know. And they let Don keep all his archive up on YouTube. It's
which
all
is
still
the,
there. He's just not
The Letterman people
to.
Are so good. As yeah. opposed to Sony, which if anyone from Sony happens to be listening to this, poo on you, because Sony is the most aggressive. I've heard from so many people who are on YouTube who post these sorts of things.
Oh.
At like anything. It's like, it's harder to find episodes like, you know, Days of Our Lives, which is Sony distributes, or The Pyramid from Dick Clark. You can find stuff, it gets up there, but eventually they find you and they track you down, even if they have no interest in monetizing it, you know, the old way. Like, I understand, look, don't post episodes of The Nanny because that's something that Sony's going to sell.
Sure.
But anyway.
But, you know, that random episode of Pyramid from 1977 is probably...
Yeah, especially since they refused to license it to a FAST platform, unlike most other game shows from the Fremantle Library. But I digress.
But I digress too, and it's fine. That was fun. See, this is the thing. We're sitting down to have our cup of coffee and talk about television and the future of streaming media. And I want to start with it starts in one place, and that you already sort of said it's going to go to YouTube here, but it starts in one place, goes to a few other places. The story that set me off, Joe, is the story that Disney has purchased the rights to Cocomelon beginning in 2027. So Cocomelon, Julia used to talk about this all the time. It was for a period of time, the number one kids show on streaming. It was one of the top shows on streaming. It was started on YouTube, went to Netflix. It was really a 600-pound gorilla. The stats have dropped off. Not that people aren't watching it, but it's not quite what it was. But now Disney has come in and said, you know, we're going to take it from Netflix and we're going to start having it in 2027. And I just thought that was, this leads me to a bunch of places, but I wanted to start there, which is sometimes I think we lose sight of the fact of some important sort of like fundamental demographic issues with certain brands. And that's my way of saying, if you're Disney, getting really young kids to watch things on Disney Plus or having things for little kids to watch on Disney Plus is like super important, because not to turn it into a completely a capitalist kind of concept here, but there is a funnel for Disney, and it's an audience funnel, and it starts with little kids, and then they get, then they, as they grow, they watch other kinds of Disney content. So in that case, Cocomelon probably has, is more valuable to Disney than it might be to any other streamer because of their kids brands.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, at the same time, you know, Netflix has announced they've did sort of a public relations deal to get Sesame Street, and you know, which is fine, and they can bring some audience to it. There's no doubt about it. But you know, I think, you know, is Cocomelon's numbers falling? Now, look, I do not claim to be an expert on children's programming or programming on Netflix, but Netflix clearly is not spending as aggressively or as much as it once did maybe 10 years ago in kids programming. They you know, all streamers early on, it was sort of like that was sort of seen as sort of the thing you need to have as a price of entry. It's why Apple TV Plus still has a generous selection of kids stuff. It was sort of thinking like, you got to be in kids if you really want to be a broad streamer. Max, knee HBO Max, knee HBO Go, knee Max again, knee HBO Max soon coming, depending upon when you listen to this podcast. You know, they had a big kids commitment when they launched 5 years ago, and now they've sort of dialed that back. And so Netflix doesn't need kids the way they used to, and they've been less aggressive at making really cool originals. They still have a lot of it, no doubt, because they're big at everything. But maybe it's just that not as many kids are watching Bluey now on Disney Plus, and they're also going to YouTube, which really owns the kids space. And it's sort of again, another spoiler. And you know, so you know, it could be that, you know, when there's less, when kids have less other reasons to open app, then maybe they're less likely, newer younger kids are less likely to get addicted, because let's remember, there has to be sort of a regeneration, right? Because kids, for certainly stuff that's aimed for a lower audience, you know, a certain age, they age out of it, right?
Yeah, so you always need new viewers down
right,
there.
Right, you need new viewers, and that's either through new shows that or old shows that can still appeal. Sometimes shows are no longer, like Sesame Street is one example where, hate to say it, for, you know, for us, it was fundamental. For millennials, definitely somewhat, but not as much. Kids today, it's not as important. It's still, a lot of kids watch Sesame Street. They love Elmo. It's still very popular, but not what it was, right? Because there's so many more options. And so you know, could Cocomelon get a resurgence? Absolutely. I don't know how much Disney spent on this. I don't know if it's been reported. And we don't know how much of Netflix's commentary is spin, because maybe Disney sort of out-hustled them, you know, and caught them when they weren't looking, or maybe not. Who knows?
Yeah, and like I said, I think, and maybe Disney just fundamentally finds it more valuable than Netflix would find it.
Yeah, because I think you're right. I think they have more to gain from it, so they can pay more, and they potentially, there's more upside. And because no one, you know, no one can brand stuff better. No one can put it, do everything. They can put it in parks. Netflix can't do all that, no matter how much they have their sort of, you know, Netflix experiences. Not the same with kids.
Yeah, exactly. Now, then I pivot to part two, which is Cocomelon started on YouTube. A lot of conversation out there. I know Julia talked about this a lot while she was doing the show, that YouTube gets overlooked when we talk about streaming. You know, it's all about Netflix and Disney and all of that. But YouTube is big, and it's even big on TV sets. There was another piece, Lucas Shaw wrote a piece this week about it, about he had a nice little anecdote about somebody who's basically shooting a sitcom for YouTube, and how like all the worlds are colliding. And, you know, he tells the whole story about they, you know, YouTube has experimented with paying for content, and that didn't really go very well. But now they're trying some other tactics, and they've definitely got the viewership. And I know you are also working on a piece about this very same issue, which is the, you know, it's almost everybody knows that YouTube is there, but when there are conversations about the impact of streaming, people often just, it's almost like it's invisible sometimes, but it's actually an enormous player.
Yeah, no, I have a story, depending upon, you know, if you read this the week of the first week of June, which is sort of, starting next Monday, the which is June 3rd, I believe, you should see a story on Vulture and in the new issue of New York Magazine, which is our Hollywood issue. I'm scheduled to have, and everything can change at the last minute, but as of now, scheduled to have a story about this, and I've been working on it for a few weeks. And the New York Times also wrote about this a year ago. YouTube is absolutely gunning for the living room, and they have been for about 15 years, really, right? It's YouTube TV. Before that, it was the Creators Initiative, and of course Suzanne Daniels had her whole division. So they've been sort of gunning for ways to make people watch on TV, but just sort of, I think during the pandemic something clicked, and what's really happened, a key thing has been that older viewers, people our age, people older, I've found YouTube, and the fastest growing group on demographic on YouTube right now is adult 65 and over.
Wow.
It makes sense because they were the slowest adopters. So right now they're going to have the heat. There's a lot more room to grow when you're starting from a lower base. Kids sort of basically these days are now just born watching YouTube. It's sort of natural. It's their electronic babysitter. But YouTube has also done a lot to sort of perfect their living room experience. They've revamped the app, and they're in the process of revamping it more. They've made it more YouTube, Netflix-like. In terms of why people don't talk about it, Jason, it is still in a different business model, right? It's in a different kind of programming. Yes, creators are doing more scripted stuff, but there aren't the same sort of premium originals that you'll find on Netflix or Disney Plus. And people still want that. And YouTube, as of now, after experimenting with that, remember, mm-hmm. Cobra Kai started out, sure. They pivoted away because as an agent told me, it didn't make the cut of my story, but as one agent told me, it's like they looked and said, yeah, why are we spending $4 million an episode on this when cat videos do twice as much viewership and get us almost as much in advertising, right? So, that's the thing. But they've been very smart. I talked to a couple of executives, their chief business officer and their head of product. They sort of decided we're going to lean into what we are. And that was smart. They briefly tried to play things according to the way Netflix has done. And in fact, if you look back about 10 years ago, analysts were saying YouTube isn't making any money at all. And the way they need to do it is they need to pivot and they become more like Netflix. And they sort of briefly listened to that advice. And that's why Suzanne Daniels. And then they quickly said, no, let's be who we are. And what you're seeing is generationally, the viewers that are native to YouTube are coming into their own. They're in the 18 to 34 demographic now. YouTube turned 20 this summer. They're adapting, and so now they are definitely winning not just the war for attention, but also cultural relevancy. And podcasts, by the way, are another thing that they've done.
Yeah,
is they've they're more people watch podcasts on YouTube than get their podcast from any other player, which is stunning for something that was named after an Apple product.
Yep.
How'd that happen?
Yeah.
Apple.
Well, it is, but podcasts are complicated and YouTube's an existing platform. It's kind of amazing. I mean, I do my big tech podcast upgrade. We now record video and that version goes on YouTube for sure, because it's an access point where people are looking for stuff who are not going to be, go get to your podcast app and then go search for our podcast. And instead things just kind of show up in a YouTube algorithm, which is pretty powerful. I find myself watching YouTube on TV a lot more than I used to personally.
Oh, for sure. Absolutely.
And it's not just that, I watch Taskmaster and Taskmaster post their episodes in the US. They just go on YouTube. And so that's a real show that I'm watching there. But I have some favorites that I subscribe to. And when those videos come out, I'm happy. And then, you know what? Honestly, there are podcasts and other clips that I see. I get... like, here's a good example. I have Peacock, but and YouTube TV for that matter, and yet I find myself often watching Seth Meyers clips on YouTube because it's just a little bit that I'm like, oh, that looks funny, or oh, that guest this time. And I'm not going to Peacock and seeing who's on Seth Meyers this week. So instead, YouTube's where I see it.
Right. And YouTube executives will say when we, because I tried to ask them about, like, you know, is Hollywood competition, vice versa. And they said, we view these people as our partners. And, you know, look, I'm always skeptical because I remember Netflix and Ted Sarandos very famously saying, it's like, we don't want to, you know, beat the studios. We don't want to compete with them. Look at what we're bringing. We want their movies and their shows because we're just a great aggregator of content. All the while, they're secretly plotting to ruin Hollywood. So could YouTube be doing the same? Maybe they just, what happened 5-7 years ago with Susan Daniels was too soon. We'll see. But I think you're right. They're a better ecosystem for it because Netflix, what YouTube essentially is now, Jason, is it's the new broadcast television.
Yeah.
You know, it really is the starting point. And they're leaning into that, their aggregation. So they made a deal, as you know, a couple years ago for direct with Sunday Ticket with the NFL.
NFL Sunday Ticket, taking it from DirecTV. Yeah.
And what was key to that with the old Sunday Ticket, you needed to subscribe to a base package on DirecTV. So you were looking at a buy-in right away of 50, yeah. 60, whatever it was a month.
Yeah.
What YouTube said is we'll do it and we'll offer it as part of YouTube TV, which is our cable bundle, right? That you now have to pay something like $70-$80 for.
Yep.
But we want to be able to sell it directly to consumers on YouTube Main. And so right now you don't need to subscribe. You pay more if you do it on YouTube Main, but it's there. By the way, not only that, about 3 years ago, they also started doing what Amazon and Apple have done for a few years, which is aggregating HBO Max.
Yeah, they're reselling other
Paramount Plus.
Other
right.
Services.
And,
yeah.
And putting into their algorithm. So suddenly you could be watching, you know, Red and Link or watching Jason Snell's podcast, and then suddenly you'll see something for The Last of Us, and with a click, you can be watching The Last of Us.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really powerful, and we're going to see even more of that. They're talking to partners like Disney. I think Disney Plus might eventually get put on there, and it really is, they're becoming sort of that starting point. And by the way, this is Apple really has sort of, I didn't get into this in my story, but you know, Apple, when they launched Apple TV Plus, executives there told me that they sort of really, their idea was to sort of become that big aggregator, which they are. They have some of that. But to really be that place where people go to get their TV first, and they've never really leaned into that.
Yeah.
Netflix never Apple never added sort of fast platform to sort of let people sort of get in that way. And their box is so expensive that there's a barrier of entry.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if Apple really wanted to play for things, they could do what, and Google, by the way, has their own Google Player, which feeds into YouTube,
yeah,
and YouTube TV, and it's cheap. And there's no reason Apple couldn't offer a box for $30 that would probably still be better than everything else and really make a play for it. But instead they don't, and that's fine. They want to be HBO, and honestly, they're doing a great job of it. But YouTube wants to be CBS, and they're doing a really good job of that too. But by the way, you mentioned one more thing. You mentioned mm-hmm. about Seth Meyers. I think it's really fascinating. I too also will watch if I ever watch a closer look, I have YouTube TV.
Yeah.
I record it. I never watch it on YouTube TV because I hardly ever open YouTube TV anymore. And I need to cancel it because it's really, I keep it just out of thinking like, well, what if I need to watch MSNBC? But once they do a direct consumer, I'm gone. You know, when Peacock was launching, one of the first things they said they were going to do was they were going to, if you remember this, they were going to allow people, subscribers, to get Jimmy Fallon's show and Seth Meyers' show at 8 o'clock Eastern time, or whenever it was, like 3 or 4 hours before it actually aired.
Yeah.
And then, of course, what happened? NBC's affiliate said, oh, no, you don't.
Mm-hmm.
We, how dare you do this to us? So they had to, they nix it. But meanwhile, it's okay if segments of the Seth Meyers show post on YouTube
before it airs.
Yeah. And so what do I do now? I don't need to wait until it airs on my NBC affiliate.
Nope.
I watch it on YouTube.
Yeah.
And within a few hours, hundreds of thousands of people have done the same, or at least views. So who knows how many people have really watched it.
Right.
But it's there because this affiliates strangle platforms like Peacock and NBC from taking advantage of things. Meanwhile, they're allowing rivals to grow. And this is where I feel sympathy for the broadcast companies and all these other players, because YouTube doesn't have to worry about any of that stuff and they can just be there and do whatever they want. But everyone else, you know, has to worry about affiliates and timing and all this other stuff. And they're protecting their short-term turf. And in the long term, they're killing the golden goose. And you know, at some point, a broadcast network's going to say, it's like, why don't we just make ourselves available on YouTube?
Mm-hmm.
Why not? If the app gets good enough, and you can have customization, sort of makes some sense.
So that pivots us into part three of this, which is YouTube being a place, a gathering place. There was a piece actually that Julia wrote this week for Puck talking about, you know, so there's a lot going on here, but basically there's a Disney distribution executive who got hired away by YouTube to head up their sports media business. And Disney is suing, saying that that guy had a contract. And therefore, you know, he can't go because he has a contract with Disney, which even though non-compete is not a thing in California, contracts are sure things. And there's actually some case law. Fox did a suit a while ago that they ended up winning about an executive who was being poached. So, but it shows you YouTube's desire to be in the sports media business. And what Julia mentioned is that, YouTube is doing a version of what we have talked about ESPN doing, which is being the nexus in a fragmented space because, you know, a majority of sports fans would tell you they're very frustrated by the fact that they don't know where to get a particular sporting event because it's now on all sorts of channels and streamers. And so this is another area where you've got ESPN launching their whole, you know, the whole ESPN streaming product, and you've got YouTube, and both of these companies see that there might be value in being the aggregator, the place you go to find out where that thing is on. And, you know, if you don't subscribe to it, you can subscribe to it right here, right? And YouTube would be happy to be the nexus of that. And ESPN brand wise should be the place where you go to find, you know, I know that sport, you know, that game is going on tonight, but I don't know where it is. I'll just go to ESPN or YouTube and look and find it and then jump off to wherever. Could be a very valuable place to be because then you can market your own stuff and steer people in other directions and also give them what they're looking for. I had never really thought about YouTube playing this game, but this hire suggests that they are absolutely playing this game too. And it's just another way that YouTube is just sort of like slowly creeping in and saying, this is what we want to do. We want to capture people's eyeballs and yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, no, well, we didn't talk about it, but they're going to air a week one NFL game this fall,
from Brazil,
right? And it'll be free, no paywall, no nothing. It should be just tune in and watch. And when we were talking about HBO and everything, they want to be an aggregator there. And you know what? I think it's inevitable. Like right now, I'm very curious to see, they've talked about this redesign, but right now, you know, they've got a pretty strong fast offering. What you and regular listeners of this podcast know, and if you read my stuff, you know about free ad-supported television. YouTube obviously is the classic fast, even though we don't think of it in the same way because of how they present. They're just sort of YouTube. They are in a league of their own, but they also sort of do partnerships where they have hundreds of free movies and free TV shows, full seasons, full catologs of stuff. It's a Living, an 80s sitcom with Anne Julian as a maid. It was Anne Julian. She was not a maid. That's It's a Living. I'm confusing. No, she was a waitress, not a maid. And it was Anne Julian, though, I think. Anyway.
Yeah, sorry. She was. Yeah. Was the one where she was a ghost? Was she also a maid? I don't even.
Yes.
Lost
Jennifer
track.
Slept Here. That was Jennifer Slept Here.
Yes,
she was not
was.
A maid.
Where,
there,
it was,
yes.
Where it was It's a Living and then it was Making a Living and they changed the cast. Anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
I didn't know we were going down the Anne Julian rabbit hole here, but there we are.
But see, that's what happens when you go on YouTube and YouTube leads you to a million different places.
Yes,
right.
Yes.
But YouTube wants to be your rabbit hole for all of Hollywood now. Hey, there's an idea. And you know, they were, by having that NFL, that's sort of a way to get people's eyeballs and to get them to start here. But anyway, so they have this fast offering. The question is, can they make it so that people can more easily find it? They rely, like Netflix, very heavily on the algorithm. But I think people sort of need to be pushed more. And they're going to do that with their new sort of TV-like experience. For a lot of creators now, when you go to your favorite shows, you will have sort of shows organized in seasons and episodes. You will have splashy landing pages with moving video. And then the question becomes, what about other tiles? And do you ever find a way to sort of put HBO content and CBS content and ESPN content and YouTube sports content and Coachella, another big thing? And so, you know, Coachella, by the way, was a huge sort of success for them again the last few years. So, they are really one to watch.
So we will keep watching there, but I'm watching it more. Everybody is. It's just true.
Yeah. Even me, old man me.
This episode of Downstream is brought to you by Terminal. If you've ever opened your phone to do something simple, like check the weather, and then found yourself doom scrolling for 10 minutes, there is a single-purpose device you might want to check out. I love this thing. It's Terminal, an e-ink display, kind of like you'd see on a Kindle, that connects with hundreds of popular apps to show you information you want to see without distracting you like a cell phone or a tablet. Most of their hardware and software is open source. There are no subscription fees. Buy it once, and you own it forever. You don't have to write any code to use Terminal, but they do have a simple developer platform with an in-browser plugin builder. Over 3,000 developers have already built 6,139 custom plugins. I bought a Terminal a few months ago. I've got it showing my upcoming calendar events for me and my wife. I've got it showing the weather. And some of that stuff is custom to me, but, you know, I was able to point it at a data source and write a little HTML like back in the 90s and got it up and running in that in-browser plugin builder in no time. Plus, of course, they've got all the stuff that is already built. So you just add it in, put in your information, it updates. And like I said, it's like a Kindle screen. It is very long battery life. It's not glowing. It's reflective like a piece of paper. And it's little. You can put it anywhere. And then at a glance, you get connected internet information, but without the distractions of pulling out your phone. Terminal, also compatible with Apple Shortcuts. This is so smart. They have a few community recipes, templates, and help docs to get you started. Basically, you build a plugin by setting up a shortcut. The shortcut pings their webhook endpoint, which is basically just a web server. You pass it data from your shortcut, and that data shows up on your terminal. It's that simple. It really is kind of like a magic trick. So you can get stuff off your computer and out somewhere else in your life onto the terminal. So basically, you know, it's your own personal server. You don't have to set up a server or host anything yourself. Now, earlier this year, Terminal was given a shout out by a bunch of YouTubers, including Quinn over at Snazzy Labs, and of course the guys on the Accidental Tech podcast, which is where I heard about it. They've been sold out until just now. They've got a new bunch of terminals in stock. So if you want to help stay focused without cutting yourself off from the world, really, you got to check out Terminal. I love mine. Go to useterminal.com. That's USETRMNL.com/go/downstream and use the code downstream and you'll get $15 off your order. 1 week only. Do it now. That's useterminal.com. USETRMNL.com/go/downstream and the code downstream for $15 off. You own it forever. No subscriptions. You don't need to run your own server. None of that stuff. Thank you to Terminal, TRMNL, for supporting Downstream. I have a weird one, which is mumbling that I wanted to talk about.
Is this a subtext of me or sub? Are you subtweeting me?
I am not subtweeting you. I promise.
I mumble a little bit anyway.
That's a mumbling problem. So it's just a story that I saw in Low Pass, which is a fun newsletter about entertainment industry stuff, linking to Netflix's tech blog where they talked about how Netflix is working with, I think, Fraunhofer to create a profiler for people who are making TV shows to judge how unintelligible or intelligible the dialogue in their show is versus background sounds and music and things, which is good. But this is this broader trend where people are talking about how it's often hard to understand dialogue. Some of that is people's ears as we age. Some of that is about the mix. Some of that is about your hardware. Like there
speakers
are a lot of
suck.
Things that are like it's 5.1 audio, but then it gets mixed down to stereo and sent it through your TV speakers. And now it sounds bad because it's done the wrong thing or it's done it badly. I think this is a really interesting topic. I've definitely had those issues occasionally where I've thought maybe the captions should go on. The story points out that younger people just leave the captions on. And that's certainly true of my kids. My kids just turn the captions on. They don't watch TV without captions. It's wild to me because I find myself reading instead of watching the show. But to them, captions is like a natural part of existence, which I would never have guessed before. So I thought that was really funny. And I also wanted to point out that Apple did this in Apple TV software last fall, where they have a dialogue enhance feature that this is exactly it. It's to improve the intelligibility of dialogue and bring it out to the forefront. And it works. It's a good feature. I think that, you know, this is going to lead to some interesting places. It may lead to essentially like alternate audio processing for people who want to hear what the heck is going on. What are they talking about on that show? And also I laugh because the low pass story mentions, in passing, sort of whatever the heck Christopher Nolan is doing, which made me laugh because, you know, that's a director who doesn't care about the intelligibility of his dialogue in his piece.
Now the thing is, can they do the same technology for visuals for so many TV shows and films that are shot in darkness and that you can't see? I mean, you know, but look, this is also a function of the fact that, hey, we live in a world where TVs are really cheap, but that also means the speakers are non-existent. And while probably many of your smarter listeners have already upgraded to a soundbar, dummies like me who are working on a 13-year-old, 14-year-old plasma screen with, you know, clearly bad speakers, probably better than the speakers of today, but still not that great. I have never invested in a soundbar. I probably should, and it's probably why the volume is always picked up, and I'm going deaf when maybe I just need a better system. And by the way, though, I also wish how did you find out about this? Just because you're an Apple geek? Because like the Apple TV never told me.
Yeah, it's a software feature, but you've got to go into settings to turn it on. But yeah, there is an enhanced dialogue setting now.
See, wouldn't it be good if like companies like Apple sent an email out to users, or maybe something when you logged in, hey, would you like to have better speech? We've added this new feature. Why not, Jason? Tell me, you're someone who studies these things and has studied Apple. Why not let people know? Like, how often have you seen sort of a viral meme about, hey, did you realize you can do this on your iPhone? And it's like a basic thing that makes people's lives so much easier. Apple's done absolutely nothing to let people know about it.
Yeah, they should. It's, you know, there's no doubt about it, because it's such a cool, I would say, listener-friendly feature, right? A reviewer-friendly feature.
But just in general, tech just has this issue, and it just, it's maddening. Yeah. But
there are also people who complain when they push something in front of you. Like, oh, why are they bugging me, and why are they selling me and marketing to me and all that? But it's like, how else would you know that this is a feature? I don't know.
Well,
I don't know.
Exactly. And, or, you know, let people opt in to, hey, would you like, yeah, anyway.
Well, in conclusion,
don't forget the cartoon from the 70s, Mumbly.
Yeah.
Or what was his name?
Mumbly? Dastardly and Mumbly, I think.
Dastardly and Mumbly,
no, it was
yes.
Muttley. It wasn't Mumbly.
Muttley.
I don't know, the
Muttley.
Nonsensical things. Speaking of which, David Zaslav, let's talk about him for a second.
Oh, God, must we? Sure.
Well, I want to go through this with you because I've been thinking about this. There are all these reports about how Zaslav is likely to sell Warner Brothers Discovery's cable channels off. Dylan Byers said to maybe even to David Ellison, who's buying Paramount, like just put him in there. Or there are some thoughts that maybe Versant, the NBC Universal SpinCo, might pick other things up or not. I thought that Dylan's analysis here was interesting. He said, it will likely only be a matter of time before Zaz's SpinCo gets sold to a much smaller media co looking to buttress its sub fees, or to a private equity firm eager to expedite the value extraction, possibly in tandem with an operating partner. Few beyond the Warner lot will care who owns Deadliest Catch, of course. And now that Turner has forfeited the NBA rights, there's really not much interest in the fate of that asset either. The asset that does warrant some consideration, at least for those who harbor some hope for the future of journalism, is CNN. So, you know, basically, I just wanted to be clear here. Zaslav was running the Discovery Networks, and that they merged with Warner Brothers and he took over. And his big moves were things like call the company Warner Brothers Discovery and put the cable brand right in the name of the company, rename HBO Max to Max and stick a whole bunch of Discovery Channel stuff like Dr. Pimple Popper on there. And now turn the page a couple of years and he's like, oh, we got to sell all that stuff. It's like, can he go with it?
Yeah. You know, well, I mean, first of all, look, I will believe, you know, you recall that when NBC Universal spun off its cable assets, it kept some of its best brands.
Well, it kept Bravo
at NBC
because,
Universal.
Yeah. Somebody right. asked me, I think it was Will Carroll 2 weeks ago, he was like, why'd they keep Bravo? And the answer is because Bravo shows do really well on Peacock and they don't want to let
exactly.
it go.
Exactly. And Discovery Plus has its own sort of like, you know, there's still a Discovery Plus that people have and it does pretty well. I still have trouble believing they're going to fully spin off all this stuff. I could see them getting rid of something like CNN, but maybe not. But maybe CNN's the one they keep because it sort of is full service. You know, I'm skeptical, but on the other hand, you know, Oliver Darcy, another great newsletter writer that you should subscribe to if you haven't already. He's independent, unlike Dylan, and he is killing it in terms of writing about the threat to our democracy. But he also writes about the business of media. And, you know, he noted David Levy, who was sort of this big Zaslav advisor, who was over at CNN the last couple of years, sort of playing sort of God knows what role. No one ever really knew what he did there except sort of get his paycheck. He's going back to Warner Brothers Discovery, but some people think that's in advance of this possible spinoff, that he would be the logical person to sort of lead a sort of new company of cable networks. In that case, by the way, NBC Universal still sort of owns Versant, or still has or Comcast at least does. So it is possible that maybe there's still some sort of connection. I don't know if they get rid of it altogether. It does not make any sense to me when scale still makes a lot of sense. But we'll see. But what it is definitely a sign of is that the actual networks, forget about the programming, the delivery system of these cable networks absolutely is a lot less than it used to be. And it's and rapidly getting worse. So maybe there's a way that, you know, the company now known as Warner Brothers Discovery gets to keep a lot of the IP. And so they keep some of their best shows. And you have the cable networks that, you know, do what they do, you know, I mean... Some of the best shows on FX don't actually air on FX cable. They're exclusive to Disney's streaming properties, right on Hulu and Disney Plus internationally. So they might have that brand, but like you could do something similar there. Mm-hmm. So, you know, 90 Day Fiancé, I can't imagine that he's going to part with that. Because the fact is, you know, that the unscripted business, they are a power. Discovery is absolutely
a power. That's their Bravo, basically. Right. Oh, by the way, Oliver Darcy's newsletter is status.news. Since you mentioned it, and Dylan, I think that Dylan's story here, like the part of it that as soul crushing as it is, it's also, this is what's happening, which is sold to a private equity firm eager to expedite the value extraction. That is what is the fate of most of these cable channels, is they're going to get sold off. And I think we had a question about this a couple weeks ago. Who would even buy them? And the answer is they're weird because these cable companies generate revenue. They are revenue generators. They're actually very profitable, but they'll never be as profitable again. And now they're even less profitable. And now they're like every minute that passes, they're less profitable, but they are still profitable. And so there are investors who that is the goal is not to grow a business. It's not to see growth or to maintain a wonderful business. Sometimes it is to maximize what they can extract from a business. And you've seen it in so many stories. Newspapers went through this. Newspapers are very clearly not a growth field, but a lot of private equity firms bought newspapers and then extracted all the value out of them until they died.
No, and I feared that what could happen to these cable networks.
That's what will happen.
Or an Elon Musk SpaceX terminology, rapid unscheduled disassembly.
I don't think it's going to be rapid, but it is, and it's going to be scheduled, but it is going to be disassembly. I will give you that.
It's not going to be.
It's going to be
happening.
Ugly.
But see, it's also, and it's this what gets me upset is because the fact is there is a good business there, and these companies. I mean, no one has been worse, honestly, than Paramount Global, which has allowed the Paramount cable networks to completely die,
right?
And for no reason, save a little bit of money, there is still an audience that wants that linear lean back programming, and there's a way to make it profitable. And Disney, on the other hand, has sort of largely figured out a way to do it.
So
you keep the brand and yeah.
I think you could argue that the best thing that could happen to some of these cable companies is being spun off somewhere where the whole point is to have these companies, because you're right, there is business opportunity there. But if you're one of these companies that is pivoted to streaming and is, you know, considers this a distraction, they're the worst stewards for those products.
Yeah. And what's really just sad is it's not about a long-term, it's not a lot about building a brand or a long-term business model. It's about short-term profits and making Wall Street happy for a few months until you get your next paycheck and until you can sell it to someone else and who can then do whatever they want. And that's the story of the last 10 years. And it's sort of like they're really, honestly, they're helping Netflix do its job. You know, we all thought, well, is Netflix going to ruin Hollywood? Well, Hollywood said, well, don't worry, we'll help you.
Yeah, yeah.
We'll ruin ourselves.
That's what I was going to say. Is that, you know, the stewards of MTV and the stewards of Sci-Fi Channel, and right, like they've already kind of ruined their channels, right? Like the value has been leached out of them already because they gave up, they stopped trying. So heavy sighs here as we move on to another sort of sad topic. I have a bunch of friends who are fans of the Amazon TV series The Wheel of Time, which just finished its third season. And has been canceled by Amazon, which, you know, I never saw it. I hear people who said that the third season was really good and that they thought it was better than the Rings of Power. So what I wanted to ask is, one, what is Amazon doing? Do they have a strategy? And two, does this mean it's closing time for Lord of the Rings at some point here, despite the fact that they spent so much money to get it? Because, you know, I'm wondering, as I always do, what is Amazon's strategy with Prime Video? Jen Psaki left, so she's out. I just don't know what they're planning on doing. And you cancel one big fantasy series, and that makes me wonder about the fate of your other big fantasy series, too.
Well, in one way, you could say, I would argue that it could potentially make things easier for Lord of the Rings, because all of these companies, they sort of all want to have different buckets of content that they're bringing to the mix, right? Netflix famously sort of focuses and they sort of want to have something for everyone. And Amazon, too, in its own way, does try to serve a whole bunch of different audiences. And you want stuff that's efficient, that can bring a lot of viewers based upon the cost per viewer. Obviously, something like when you spend so much money on a show, you need even more viewers to make it work. The Lord of the Rings has done fine in terms of audience. It generates a lot of billions of minutes according to Nielsen, but it costs so much that is it worth it? I don't know. Wheel of Time does okay, but not nearly. But I don't think it has done as well ratings wise as Lord of the Rings. It certainly hasn't had the same resonance. Lord of the Rings gets a lot of. I'm speaking as someone who loves, not loves, I enjoy Lord of the Rings. I thought the last season was okay, not great.
Yeah.
It's a fun show. It's an interesting show. I watch it and I like it. Do I think they should need to spend as much money as they do on it?
No.
Not really. I think I would enjoy it just as much if it would cost half as much to make.
Yeah.
But who am I to tell these people how to do their job? Well, I guess that sort of is my job, but so if they only have a certain amount of money, a bucket of money that they want to spend on certain kinds of genres, well, if you're getting rid of Wheel of Time, that means, well, more likely you're going to want to keep, you know, it's the same way if you get rid of, you know, one Law and Order, you're probably going to keep the other two because you want to keep that Law and Order bucket running.
Right. So the idea there is Wheel of Time probably brings in a very similar audience to Lord of the Rings. You don't really need to spend the money on both of them.
Because people aren't, you're right. People are, exactly. And, but I do think, you know, I think beyond three seasons, and I can't imagine that Lord of the Rings is going to go more than four seasons. I mean, this is a story with a finite storyline anyway. And given the cost, I can't imagine it's not going to run for 15 years. So, you know, if it gets three seasons, I think that's enough where they can say, hey, this wasn't a failure. We did three seasons and in the Netflix era, three seasons is considered success now, apparently. And it gives you 30 episodes and it lives on, and then, you know, why not?
My gut feeling is that when they signed the deal with Amazon, it was during the heady flush days where they felt like they were going to be able to tell this entire story from this book series, and they were going to get, you know, six seasons in a movie or however you wanted to put it, like enough for them to do it. But the economics have changed, and that's just how it goes. I don't know if there is a streamer that is more hard to read and has pivoted directions as many times as Prime Video. I still am not clear what even is Prime Video. It's an assortment of things and I watch things on it, but I couldn't even tell you what I think the brand promise of Prime Video is.
It's to be part of the flywheel of Amazon. And that's what different, well, I mean, that sounds whatever, but I've talked about it. And I think it is because they have shows that do help move product, and they get people to open the app, and they want to sell subscriptions but they're also an aggregator. They're making money every time they sell a subscription to Max, and they probably have the most successful channels business, as far as I can tell. They're doing a better job than Apple and even probably YouTube at getting people there. So they've spent a lot on classic, or they license a lot of classic TV and then they're an advertising business. That's what they also really are in. They are not in the premium business the way that Apple is, or even Max is to a degree. They're in the business of, do we have a lot of content that advertisers want to be on? Because they sort of, you know, they got a lot of flack from consumers by doing this, but they, unlike everyone else, they didn't sort of institute like, oh, different tiers. Everyone became an ad-supported customer on a certain date. You had to opt in if you wanted to go ad-free.
Right.
Everyone else sort of did the opposite way. It's like, well, if you were already ad-free, you can downgrade and, well, you don't have to pay. But it was active. They really want, and they're billing more money in advertising than anyone but YouTube in the digital space, certainly more than Netflix.
Wow.
So they're sort of, they want to be sort of in the same way we're talking about YouTube wanting to be network television.
Yeah, network TV.
I think Amazon is sort of that too. And that was their vision for Freevee. And then they sort of said, you know what, let's just make that the vision for
Amazon Prime Video.
Exactly. Yeah. Which is why the Academy of Country Music Awards, or one of those country music awards, is now going to be based on Amazon for a couple more years. And they've got sports, Thursday Night Football.
Yeah.
So that's sort of their strategy is.
All right.
Do they have the brand? No, they're not very good at giving you that connection to the brand, which I think is a mistake. And I've said that to executives there. I think, but to them, it's all in service of Amazon, which again also brings to why we have Lord of the Rings to begin with. It's because Jeff Bezos wanted it.
Yep.
That's why we did it.
That's it. That is the truth. All right, I have a letter from a listener. People can send their feedback, downstreamfeedback.com. And this one is from Billo. It is feedback from a couple weeks ago when I had Will Carroll on, and Billo writes, "Wow, Will had some wild ideas in the latest episode. I don't necessarily agree with any of them, but I love that he is on the show, and it makes me think in a good way, not the really makes you think bad internet meme way." I also heard from quite a few. I mentioned this letter because I also got a few letters that were like, "Please have the man who talks about gambling not be on the show anymore." And this is what I will say to that is, if you don't think there are powerful forces out there that want to make huge amounts of money putting gambling in everything, you are fooling yourself, because it's absolutely the case. And Will comes from the sports world. That is the place where, you know, you can say it's evil, it's corrupt, whatever. I'm not a gambler. I don't love it. But it to ignore its impact and the fact that media companies and gambling companies keep thinking about ways to put gambling in front of people, especially on digital platforms. I think it's very, very important to consider this when we're considering, especially in sports, what the future of sports on streaming media looks like. When we talk about sports streams not having, high latency, because the more latency you put in, the less betting you can do. Like, that's going to be a consideration, and I think that that's an issue more broadly for everyone. I mean, when my phone tells me that the Giants have scored a run before I see it, that kind of stinks, right? Like, I mean, it does have other impacts, but like, it is a huge motivator. That money and the gambling industry is driving a lot of things, especially in sports. Now, I will say, I thought Will's suggestion that we're going to have a virtual Vin Scully calling baseball games, that was the one that I thought was bananas. But you know what? I love that Will, who has made so many contacts in the sports industry over his years, all the way back to when he was one of the early people at Baseball Prospectus, I think he comes from a viewpoint that we often miss about what the way people in the sports industry are thinking about where things are going. So that's why I like to talk to Will about that stuff. As Billo said, makes me think in a good way. I don't necessarily agree, but I love that he makes me think in a good way. So that's my answer to people who are complaining about gambling stuff. We're not endorsing gambling. We're not endorsing sticking gambling everywhere. But I think that you'd be mistaken not to imagine that those calculations are not happening out there in the world, because they are.
In other words, don't shoot the messenger.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he Will's deep down in it, and I think Will, in my sphere, gambling stuff, like when Apple put odds in the Apple Sports app, everybody in my sphere was like, I can't believe they did this. This is so evil. How dare they? And I was like, huh, they put the odds in there. Well, I mean, this is, I don't like it, but this is the world that we live in, and then there's a switch in settings to turn it off. So you can just turn it off. But like, it was an interesting moment where it's like, from a sports perspective, this is the most logical thing you would do. And from at least this particular sort of group of tech enthusiasts, it was shocking. And I thought, I think that's kind of interesting that one audience thinks that it's shocking and the other audience is like, what are you even talking about? So,
well, the same thing is with AI as well. But I mean, honestly, if you're angry about this, and I did not listen to the segment and I don't have any opinions on his coverage, but I will say this, I am concerned about the someone who grew up in Las Vegas and currently lives in Nevada still, where gambling was always used to be sort of a very special thing you had to come here to do. And so I sort of wish he still had to come here. I think it would be better for, for our economy. And you know, because Atlantic City sure couldn't do it, and now it's everywhere. There's something to be said for the fact that we've made gambling too easy and commoditized and for profit. And you know what? You should write your congressman. Of course, it won't do any good because now our government is pro-gambling. And in fact, once you put all their money into the Trump meme coin, which is another form of gambling.
See, Joe,
so,
now I'm going to get letters about that.
Every time I visit my
mom in Arizona, I see all the ads because there's no gambling on sports legally in California. So I go to Arizona and I see all these ads. I'm like, oh my God, but that is, and that's a lot of money. That's driving a lot of money. Those ads, you know, the baseball teams and the broadcasters are getting all the gambling ad money. Like, it's a huge thing.
What's wrong with our young men? They're broke and they're desperate because they're losing it all on gambling.
They're using their phones to gamble.
By the way, it's ridiculous. Like, you need to be 21 years old to drink, but you can do all this other stuff, including gamble at 18. And how does that make any sense? Well, or maybe you do you have to be 18? Can you gamble at 18?
I don't know. That's you might need to be 21.
I know in Vegas you might be 21, so maybe I'm wrong on that. But you know, it's dangerous. And oddly enough, though, in Nevada, where we're the only state, I think maybe the only state, no lottery.
Interesting. Spend your money elsewhere.
Yeah, you got to go to the casino because big casino wins. So, like, when we want to play the Powerball, you got to go 100 miles to California.
Yeah, sure.
Or Arizona. Yeah.
All right. Before we go, let us do a set of TV picks. Do you have a suggestion for people to watch?
Well, more sort of a genre on a certain platform, and that's Netflix comedy. And I'm a little bit behind with some things. So for some of your listeners, be like, Dalian, wake up. This is not new. But I'm really getting into Netflix comedies lately. Right now, I have to admit, I've only watched the first 2.5 episodes, but I'm all in on the Tina Fey Four Seasons, sort of genetically engineered for a person of a certain age. It's a remake of the movie, which is also on Netflix, which is very good of them to finally license it somewhere. But it's Tina Fey and Steve Carell.
Oh, man, I gotta watch that.
And also Will Forte, Coleman Domingo. And it's a tight 8 episodes. There's gonna be a second season, so it's not limited, but it's basically like the movie. It's basically a year in the life on 4 different vacations of a group of friends. And it's just great seeing the dynamics. But it's also sort of upscale comedy that Netflix has done really well lately. You know, they're different shows but they've also, I've enjoyed watching weekly because I make my own sort of schedule of watching these episodes weekly as opposed to all at once. Running Point, which is the Kate Hudson comedy. Nobody Asked for This, and A Man on the Inside, which came in last fall. You probably, both of them were great. But, you know, Netflix for the longest time was having a problem with comedies. I think they've sort of figured it out. They, you know, their head of comedy has really found how to do adult comedies in a way that worked for Netflix. And the only thing I wish they would do is more sitcoms that aired on a weekly basis. But you know what?
We've already covered
spinning
that
to the
one,
wind
right?
there. So yeah, it's not going to happen, Joe, is what Netflix executives tell me. So there you go. But you know what? It could and it should. But for right now, but these shows, by the way, these shows are just as good as a binge. They definitely work as a binge. But honestly, do what I do. Treat yourself. Watch an episode or two every week or so.
Slow binge.
It lasts longer. Mm-hmm. It's fun.
Slow binge.
Slow binge, baby.
Even if it's one episode every night or one episode every few nights, I'm okay with that. But yeah, don't wolf them down in one sitting. You could, but don't, is what I would say.
Exactly.
I'm going to recommend The Return of Welcome to Wrexham on Hulu. It is a sports documentary. Yes, it is about Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds. Yes, but it is also about that town in Wales and how it's been affected by the crushing blows of history and then these Hollywood guys buying their soccer team, and it's kind of an underdog story, but it's also now kind of not an underdog story because they've gotten famous. It's really interesting. I think it's a very well done documentary, and it's back for another season, where unless you Google what happened to Wrexham this year, you can find out whether they make it a record third straight promotion to a higher league in the English soccer pyramid. So yeah, it's a good show. I enjoy it. I think it's very well done. So don't let, I mean, if you can't take Ryan Reynolds, you're not going to like it, but like it's not wall to wall Ryan Reynolds. It's got a lot in it.
I only learned this week for the first time when my friend Mike Schneider wrote this, I think it was Mike who wrote at Variety, that, his wife is, the woman from, High Potential, who I guess also is on, am I right?
Rob McElhenney's wife. Yeah. From High Potential. Who's also, It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. And yeah, she's everywhere right now.
And is in Hacks. Oh, by the way, took me the longest time.
DJ,
I didn't realize
Hacks,
that she is such a different character that I didn't, even when I was watching High Potential, I didn't even realize that was her. And then all of a sudden it's like, oh wait, that's her. She is. Yeah. They, you know, so, I need to know, maybe she'll get me to watch It's Always Sunny, this new show that I've heard so much about.
Maybe so. It's yeah, she's really great. Okay, that brings us to the end. If you haven't yet, please consider subscribing to Downstream Plus. This is a full-sized episode for everyone. The only way to hear the complete version of our next episode in a couple weeks and hear ad-free episodes is to subscribe. You can do that at downstream.plus. You can find me at sixcolors.com, and I appear on many other podcasts here at Relay, as well as over at theincomparable.com. And Joe, where can people find the stuff you do?
You can read me on Vulture.com and New York Magazine in print this week. You can find me on Blue Sky at TV Mojo, MOJOE. And you can sign up for my newsletter called Buffering, which is free. And it comes every week, every other week. You know, we're not too specific about that, but you know, it's some good stuff and it's free.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, thank you for dropping in again this time. I'll try to have you back next time as well. And thanks to everybody out there for listening to this episode of Downstream. We'll see you next time.